Hello, folks. This week's guest is Robbie Fox from Barstool Sports. Robbie is an incredibly talented guy. He has been with Barstool since 2017. I think he's 22 years old, and already he has achieved so much. You probably know Robbie from the Barstool content as the biggest Conor McGregor fan. The sketches he made for McGregor's court case in New York were just pure genius. He was in the three-piece suit, protesting Conor's innocence, interviewing people on the street. It was just hilarious. But this guy, he's been in Barstool, you know, from a very young age. He is the main guy when it comes to MMA in Barstool. He is the MMA guy, the go-to guy for MMA content. He has a podcast called My Mom's Basement. Brilliant podcast. He's had such guests as Stone Cold Steve Austin, Dana White he's had on. He's had on Daniel Cormier, Chris Jericho, Rey Mysterio, you name it. Robbie is a stand-up guy, a really, really talented guy, and at such a young age has achieved so much in his young career. So yeah, I mean, you're going to enjoy this. He's the biggest Star Wars fan ever. He's a wrestling fan like me. We talk about MMA. We cover absolutely everything that is pop culture in this podcast, and I hope you guys enjoy it. And yeah, that's it. Episode 8 of The Impressionable Era with Al Forn. This is Robbie Fox. Have a good weekend, folks. Robbie Fox, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for coming on, pal. How are you?
Dude, thank you for having me. I told you it was an honor, and I made sure to throw the U in there for you as well, because we don't use that U. It's unnecessary. But hell, I threw it in there for you. I'm happy to be here, Al. We talked a little bit before we started recording, but it's been a while since we've like actually gotten to talk to each other, so this is fun.
Absolutely. 2 years.
Yeah.
Two years and a bit, I think. It was New Orleans. It was WrestleMania week. It was my first WrestleMania, so I was just buzzing all week. Pat McAfee got in touch with me to do, I think he was besotted by my Conor McGregor impression. He loved it so much.
Yes. I remember him reaching out to you because it was the day that Conor threw the dolly at the bus. Yes. Or it was maybe the day after. It was like literally right in that span.
Yeah.
And I remember him like watching it next to me. You did some impression that day and we were all like dying. And we were like, we got to get this guy here, when we realized you were there. And then we saw you like 5 times that week, just running into the weirdest time. Like we would be in the stall of a bathroom. We heard an Irish guy and Pat was like, Al? And he was like, Pat? Like, what the fuck? Yeah.
That was a great week, I have to say. I think we met at the Hall of Fame and everything. Like, I met, yeah. It was you, your brother Evan there. So it was great, crack it was. I mean, I've never experienced anything like that, honestly.
No, me neither. New Orleans was the perfect city for WrestleMania. I've been to a few at this point, and like the most recent in New York. I love New York as like a city. I don't love living there, but I love like being there and stuff, the convenience of it. It's a weird city for WrestleMania because it's almost too big. Like New Orleans had Bourbon Street where the fans could take over and it was so much fun. Every bar had the wrestling themes going, you know, the fans, no chance, that's what you got. New York, it was kind of just like you didn't get the sense that the wrestling fans had taken over the city.
Yeah, everything is so stretched. I mean, I'd imagine the access is miles away from the MetLife Stadium.
Yeah, MetLife Stadium is literally in New Jersey. So you have to get on a train for like 15 minutes to even get there. Whereas the Superdome, we all walked from Bourbon Street, basically. And then you walked to Bourbon Street right afterwards. It was nice.
But listen, I want to talk to you. I mean, since I've met you, you've risen so much. Like you've gotten recognition. Of course, you're getting recognition over in America, but you've got major recognition in Ireland, you know. But you started in Barstool. Like, how old were you when you started?
So I got hired when I was 19, when I was freshman in college. I had just come to university, sorry. But I started applying to Barstool when I was 13. Literally, I have a bunch of older cousins, and my older brother's 12 years older than me. My sister's 9 years older than me. So I've always had like sort of an older influence in that. And they showed me Barstool probably way sooner than they should have, given the brand of humor. But I loved it right away. And I just got the sense that it was literally like a bunch of friends kind of shooting the shit, bullshitting and getting paid to just be friends. And that seemed like a fun time. They seemed to like talk about stuff the way I talked about stuff. Yeah. And I loved it. So I started applying when I was 13. Nobody covered MMA at that point, and I loved MMA. Yes. Like, hey, this is a perfect connection. And I got a reply from Big Cat, who is now one of, you know, our biggest personality, other than Dave. He is the biggest personality. I got a reply from him when I was 14, when I was a freshman in high school. And he said, I think it just said, dude, we can't hire a 14-year-old. And I was just like, yes, that's my foot in the door. He replied. He replied. So I just kept going, right? And I started my own blog in high school. Covering MMA and wrestling. It was called The Squared Octagon, Squared Circle Octagon, you know, mismatch. Yeah. I started designing t-shirts and sending them to Dave and Barstool and whoever I could every day, most of which were horrible, like legit like MS Paint style t-shirts. But I was just, like I said, trying to get my foot in the door any way I could. Yeah. I started designing gear for professional wrestlers. I wound up designing some of the gear for the Young Bucks, Kevin Owens, Cody Rhodes, like some actually big names. Yeah.
Huge names.
And eventually Barstool got bought by the Chernin Company, or Chernin Entertainment. And it was the year I graduated from high school. So I was like, oh man, this is perfect. I've got a car. They're moving to New York. I'm from New Jersey, right? 14 miles outside of the city. So I waited until they hired all of their interns. And then I sent an email to every single Barstool blogger who had not hired an intern. And I said, listen, I know you're paying interns, whatever. I'll work for free. I don't care. I just want my foot in the door. And I got hired by The Golf Guy. So for my first like year at Barstool, I covered golf and like world politics, world news. I don't know anything about any of these topics. The first golf course I ever stepped foot on in my life was Augusta National, where they play the Masters. Oh my God, golf fans were upset about that. They were like, this ungrateful son of a bitch is walking on Augusta.
Wow.
But yeah, that was my foot in the door. And then through that internship, I basically went to Dave and said, hey, you know, I've been running this blog for a year, 2 years now. You could see I cover MMA. Nobody covers MMA here. Do you think I could publish maybe one blog a day on MMA? And it just kind of expanded from there. And when he saw people took a liking to it, he pulled me from the golf podcast, which I was producing, and said, hey, just do your own stuff. Do your own content.
Absolutely,
And you know, go ahead.
That's incredible, because I think with Barstool, kind of the core interests in terms of sports, it would have been ice hockey, American football, basketball, the whole lot. Like they really didn't cover MMA. Well, they would. They'd probably cover the big stories in MMA with the likes of Ronda Rousey, McGregor, and Brock Lesnar. But when you came along, like you were bent into place, and like you are the MMA guy there.
Yeah, and I very much wanted that, because, like I said, I was such a fan of Barstool that I wanted, like, man, I'm a huge hockey fan, right? So I saw the guys talking about hockey, and I was like, man, it would be awesome if someone were talking about MMA like that, in just a sense of when it's brought up on The Rundown or one of our flagship shows. Yeah. It was usually brought up in the sense of like, oh yeah, Ronda Rousey, another like armbar. Nobody's ever going to beat her, right? Yeah. Where I would love to like step in there and be like, well, wait, like who knows? There, you know, the game could move faster. Or give a little more... give a little more detail for like the casual fan. That's always my goal, is kind of showing to the casual fan, hey, MMA is awesome and it's very easy to get into.
Absolutely. I mean, I would consider myself a casual fan. Absolutely. A lot of people say, oh, you probably started watching it when Conor McGregor got into it because you do the impression. No, I started watching it when Brock Lesnar.
I'm with you.
Brock Lesnar, in his debut fight against Alex
Same Scott. Exact thing for me.
It was the intrigue of seeing Brock Lesnar get into an octagon. And I had heard of the likes of, you know, Tito and Chuck and Rampage. They were the big names before that, and George as well. But it was when, like, Brock Lesnar literally, he just exploded that sport. He was the first kind of person to bring it to the worldwide audience. Absolutely.
Yeah, he's got to be. And that fight, I remember watching, and he pummels Mir for like the first minute of it. And it's just like, oh my God, Lesnar's the same guy he is in the ring, in the octagon, right? Going crazy. But then he gets tapped right away in like the tiniest little hook. And that was like my interest in MMA right there. I was hooked for life when Lesnar got tapped, because I was like, what do you mean he just lost that fight? He was winning. And then he tapped out. He gave up. That just like my imagination was mind blown, because I was like, this is literally like I'm watching superheroes fight. They look like action figures. They're really fighting. They're cutting promos beforehand. It is sort of like a real life wrestling. still, like, I still get that when they did the thing at UFC, whatever, when Lesnar got into the cage and pushed DC, and everyone's like, oh, we hate that, right? It's wrestling. I still go crazy for that because I'm like, yes, that's what got me into this sport.
I loved it. I love that as well. And it's a shame, actually, nothing happened from that.
I know.
A terrible shame. But yeah, like, even in his second fight, I think his second fight was Ed Herring, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That was when he laid down the marker.
Like, yes.
Yeah, this guy.
And then he got the rematch with Mir at UFC 100, and then it was like, okay, Brock Lesnar's the real deal, and he had that aura around him of invincibility for a bit.
I just found him so. There's something about Brock Lesnar. I find him hilarious as a person. I think.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's how wound up he was by Frank Mir. You know, in that first fight, I think he was interviewed and he was punching things and everything, and he just wanted to get that win against the mayor, and he hated him so much as well. But it was must-see TV, you know.
He's also got maybe the funniest, most diverse echelon of post-fight interviews, because he's got some where he's like, I'm going to go to the back and fuck my wife and drink a cold beer. And then he's got some like...
don't pay me nothing.
Literally. And then he's got the one from UFC 200 after he beats Mark Hunt, where he was like holding a Canadian flag for some reason. And he's like, I think the world needs to be a better place, everybody. We need to treat each other better. And it's like, Brock Lesnar, are you the voice of reason now? I mean, sure.
Stop. He is a character. I'd like to hear more of him on the mic, actually, as well. Paul Heyman's great, but it is nice to hear Lesnar.
No, I'm with you, especially because like Heyman is great, but he's also cut the same promo for like 4 years now. Where I'm like, All right, Paul, we get you're not just, you know, it's a spoiler alert. It's not a prediction. It's a spoiler. Brock Lesnar.
Yeah, everything is the spoiler. Yeah, the whole spoiler alert. Back to yourself. I think the first time I came across yourself was when you approached Floyd Mayweather Sr.
Yeah.
with the 49-1 t-shirt.
Yeah.
He took a swing for you and everything, didn't he?
He took a few swings at me and legitimately seemed to want to go out to the parking lot with me to fight me. But that was so great, because that was very much a case of like, I was trying to become the MMA guy at that point. And Connor was already my favorite guy. And I was I an intern at that point? I think I had just gotten hired full time.
Yeah.
We had a SiriusXM show, just Barstool Radio. Now we have a full channel. It's all day. Yeah. Channel 85 is Barstool. But we just had one show at that point. And Sirius said, hey, we'll send four of you guys out to the Mayweather-McGregor fight out of some sponsorship thing. Yeah. And originally, Dave, my boss, wasn't going to take me. He was just like, oh, like, I'll bring like the big guys from Barstool out. And I was like, no, we can't. There's no way Barstool could go to a Conor McGregor fight and not bring like, I'm like the Conor McGregor guy. Like, This is my guy. So I sent Dave like a scathing email. And as an like a recent hire, this was really a bold move, but I pretty much said, if you don't bring me, I will pay out of my pocket to bring my own cameraman and I'll show up your content. And he brought me on radio the next day and was like, listen, I loved that initiative. He's like, you'll come. He's like, all right, I'll bring you. He's like, we'll do it. So I had been saying the entire week, listen, if I see anyone with the TMT hats, I'll go up to him. I'll get a funny video. I was just really like, I needed to make good content that week because I had sent that email to Dave. So I was like, the pressure was sort of on for me. And I saw Floyd Mayweather Sr. at our table early in the morning. I think it was like, you watch the video and it seemed like an uproar, but I think it was like 10 a.m. And I was buttering a bagel and I had like a Coca-Cola buttering a bagel. And I looked over and I saw Floyd Mayweather Sr. at our station and I just dropped my bagel. It was like The Usual Suspect when he drops the mug at the end of the movie. And I just started running over there. I was initially shirtless. I didn't even have a shirt on because I showed up media day that day in Connor's Brooklyn outfit when he had the mink robe with the pajama pants on. So I was shirtless and he started telling me before the camera started rolling, is this guy? Put a shirt on. Why don't you put a shirt on? So I said, all right, you want me to put a shirt on? I'm putting a shirt on. And I threw on the 49-1 and then he, you know, that sent him over the edge. He started wings at me. And Ice Cube, one of the sneakiest parts of this whole thing, was sitting at our table on radio. And he was supposed to be promoting the Big Three, his basketball tournament, and we just never got to that. So at the end of the segment, Dave was like, listen, Ice Cube, I'm really sorry we couldn't promote that for you. Our intern just got into a fight with Floyd Mayweather's dad. And his exact words, which I'll never forget, he put a hand on my shoulder. Ice Cube put a hand on my shoulder. He said, don't worry.
Greatest rapper ever, yeah.
Arguably the greatest rapper ever. Put a hand on my shoulder. He said, don't worry about it. Felt like I was in my grandma's living room. Amazing. I was just like, I'll never have a more Mad Libs moment than that in my life, where I got Floyd Mayweather Sr. swinging at me and Ice Cube putting a hand on my shoulder telling me, it's all right, son. I felt like I was at home. Like, what?
But Robbie, that's the thing. It's the spontaneous moments that are the best and the most impactful. I mean, I had a similar one a couple of months prior to the Mayweather-McGregor fight, where I was called up on stage with Floyd Mayweather.
Dude, I know the video you're talking about because it's legendary. You do the Tyson impression for him. Am I right?
Tyson. I did Trump. I did Joe Pesci, De Niro, and of course, Conor. I remember being asked to do that maybe 45 minutes before. I literally had 45 minutes notice. And
was your heart racing?
Oh, fucking breaking it, man. The nerves were at 90. They were, oh my God. But I tell you, like, and I was thinking to myself, oh no, I shouldn't do this. Oh God, no, no, no. I just went with it. I just said, fuck it. But a mate of mine was there. He goes, imagine, like, he goes, I'm going to record this. And imagine if you pull this off, you know, you put it on social media the next day and it'll blow up. And
totally. And yeah, that's like you understand the world so similarly.
That was my plane ticket to Vegas. I was in Vegas too, Rafi. That was my plane ticket.
Dude, you understand like the world of social media so well in terms of like your content and Barstool's content, mine in particular, like the Connor stuff is very similar because like you said, it's like that one spontaneous thing, you get it off and it blows up. Like the week of the Khabib fight, Connor pointed to me and he was just like, hey, Robbie, 30 second clip. I don't think I say like pretty much no words. That's by far the most viewed thing I've ever put up on social media. I think it got like millions of views immediately because it was just the spontaneous thing of, oh my God, someone called him out. Yeah. And that's the beauty of Twitter because, oh my God, without that, like, I don't know what I would be doing.
Well, that was part and parcel of the content, the lead up content that you did in 2018, like outside the court for his court case in his suit. I mean, that got to Ireland, man. That got to Ireland. People were loving that.
Well, that was honestly my biggest eyes-opening experience of I immediately saw that it got to Ireland because I think RTE was there and they picked up a quote, which I don't know why, like they picked up this quote, but I was standing there with the ridiculous signs, the double champ screaming my head off, right? The only protester there. And I think they picked up some quote where I said, I think all charges should be dropped and put onto the bus driver because in a different video, I heard the bus driver request that Connor throw the dolly up there for him. And I think RTE put that in there. And I was like, what in the world? So I immediately got an influx of DMs from Ireland of, oh, you mad cunt, you're a legend. You know, if you ever come over to Ireland, we got a couch for you to crash on. And that's like my favorite thing whenever I cover a Conor fight and meet Irish people. It's the first thing they always say. They're like, oh, you could crash on my couch if, you know, you want to come over.
That's the thing. We're a wild bunch, man. I mean,
I love it. I love it. You've been very welcoming as a nation to me. So I'm all in.
But I mean, it's kind of similar with the Conor fights. There's such an unbelievable atmosphere. And it's the same, obviously. I mean, if you see the soccer as well for the international tournaments. Like, the Irish fans were given the keys to the city of Paris for the European Championships in the soccer. They loved us that much. Yeah.
Yeah,
we created such a brilliant atmosphere. And a team.
Dude, I've watched documentaries before on the hooligans, the old school hooligans, where it was like the Celtic versus oh my God, where they would like after matches just go out and have like murder brawls in the streets. Insane. You guys maybe a little too passionate back in the day.
No, it's not as bad as it used to be. Fortunately, it's gotten a lot better. You know, there's still a few odd clubs. I don't know if you heard of like Millwall. They're pretty bad. They're
I don't know.
They made a movie about hooliganism of Green Street with Elijah Wood and Charlie Hunnam. I think it came out in 2005, and it was all about the West Ham fans and the Millwall fans. Obviously, they're both football clubs in East London, and it's all about them scrapping each other. And
who's your team? Do you have a Premier League team? You do, right?
Oh, man, I'm Man United.
Man United.
See my Twitter? I've been... supported.
Now this is going to be the most ignorant question of all time. You're going to be like, Jesus Christ, you fucking Yankee. Man United is red, right? Man City is light blue. Okay,
yes.
So you're anti my Oasis brethren, Noel and Liam Gallagher.
Yeah.
All right, fair enough.
Even though I fucking love those two. Well,
how could you not?
I mean, I see you're always tweeting about them. I mean, I wish they'd just cop on and fucking make up. You know?
Bro, can they not get on a Zoom meeting and just like mute each other and just play your parts separately so we could hear it? Like, you could figure it out, man. Motley Crue, I think on their last tour, they each had a separate tour bus. Figure it out where Noel and Liam could like perform on opposite sides of a stadium and never have to talk to each other, but we could still have Oasis back. Come on. All right. We could stop talking about Oasis. I always rant about them.
100 million in the bank. There you go.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, apparently they turned down 130 million they got offered last year to reunite, and Noel said, fuck that.
Obviously, I mean, it's so bitter. I mean, the only key in those two making up is the mother, is Peggy.
I agree.
That's you know, they're come a point where the mother gets so sick of them, you know, hating each other, that, you know, she'll probably end up bringing the band together.
I agree completely. I've actually said like those exact words to people. I'm like, I'm telling you, Peggy's going to bring them back together.
It's 100%. I mean, we have, there's a place, Slane Castle, where a lot of the big gigs happen in Ireland.
Chili Peppers, that's legendary.
Legendary, man. I was at Guns N' Roses 2 years ago as well.
Wow.
It's an unbelievable, like, for a summer's gig, there's no place like it. And Oasis supported REM in 1995. That was their first, I believe it was their first gig in Ireland, first big gig in Ireland. And then they headlined Slane in 2009, just before they broke up. And a lot of my mates went to that gig and said, like that, the two, like, Liam was here and Noel was over here. They couldn't have been further apart. There was no communication whatsoever.
Yeah, no. The videos from that final tour in 2009 are crazy. There's videos of like Noel crying on stage as Kermit is singing "Stop Crying Your" sounds like Kermit.
Yeah,
and he's singing "Stop Crying Your Heart Out." And Noel's legit. He just has tears. He's like, "This is over."
It's done. So, listen, man. That's one of my biggest wishes. Every day I think about that.
Every day I think about that, man. Literally every day I'm like, because I never got to see him ever. So I'm like, I just need Oasis to come back for me.
I think it's gonna happen. I mean, I always
I've
say
got, if, here. I've got Live Forever.
Oh man.
Yeah.
What's your favorite album? Definitely Maybe. Morning Glory.
It's so tough. I probably say What's the Story, but my favorite Oasis song is Supersonic. There's nothing more like that embodies the spirit of that band, the spirit of Liam when they like broke onto the scene, than that song. Like, Gimme Gin and Tonic. Like, come on. That's straight rock and roll Oasis. Like, roll the windows down, drive fast on the highway. Yeah. It's the best.
It's a perfect damn walkout song as well.
It is. Imagine sitting in that arena with that drums kicking, that punk rock drum beat. Oh my God, that would be awesome.
It'd be awesome, man.
Not enough people come out to Oasis. That Morning Glory itself would be awesome with like the helicopters, you know, going off. Like, that would be kind of sick too.
It'd be class, wouldn't it? If any UFC fighters are listening to this.
Dude, I just got to start doing it myself. They say, be the change that you want to see in the world. I got to start doing push-ups, get myself to the UFC.
Oh, my God. Look, we're talking about your rise in Barstool and getting to the Conor Khabib fight. You were very kind of, with your Khabib content, it was a little bit touch and go. It was.
Yeah.
were you nervous going to Vegas for that fight?
You can't imagine how nervous I was going to Vegas.
And excited as well, I'd imagine.
Excited, yes, but the nervousness probably outweighed the excitement because I was getting such graphic, insane death threats on a daily basis via Twitter DM, via email, via whatever you may have it, that it was like sort of scary. And people kept tagging like Ali Abdelaziz, Khabib's manager. They kept tagging him in a bunch of tweets, like just sharing my location. So if like I was on the strip, someone would tag Ali and be like, he's by Caesar's Palace right now. And I was like, okay, do we have to like seriously go to our hotel right now? We stayed off the strip. It was me and a cameraman who was my cameraman also with me for the Cowboy fight. And I said like, that was, oh my God, it was night and day because Cowboy fans were coming up to us like, Barstool, you're the best, Robbie. We can't wait for this fight. Whereas that fight, like we were just getting dirty looks and I was walking around with, you know, you always see me, I wear the same thing all the time. Backwards hat, like a stupid t-shirt, whatever. I was wearing like a forwards hat covered, like I was an Avenger trying to act incognito. I was wearing a medical mask in pre-corona days, like literally a medical mask just because I was afraid of people. The UFC eventually caught on to this and moved me from Khabib's section at weigh-ins. Like part of Khabib's team, AKA, came in and we were getting dirty looks. The UFC like moved us. And I found out later on that very specifically, they were told like, oh yeah, that guy, Robbie Fox, is causing issues. So whatever. And then it eventually came to a head, I guess, at the fight itself, where I got a DM the day before the fight. I was going to go as just a credentialed like media member from Audiatar, Connor's manager. And he was like, Connor would love to give you a ticket to the fight. And this is like, for me, a lifelong Connor McGregor fan, right? Literally, like huge, people said, man, you got into UFC when he came in, whatever, like same thing as you. Very much not the case. And he is the pro wrestler, the prototypical, like burst onto the scene, did everything he said he was going to do. The rise, the way he antagonized Jose Aldo and that entire thing. Yeah. I went to school. I'll never forget this kid, Alex Pratisoli was his name, Brazilian kid that I went to high school with. And he was talking so much shit into the Aldo fight. And I was giving them a, uvamo head. And he was cracking up, right? So I was just like, I couldn't believe this was the case. I get the ticket. And when I get to my section, I realize I was sitting on opposite sides of me were Connor's bodyguards. So Connor sat me like near his security, which I thought was like, man, I'll never entire life, like I'll always be grateful for that. You know what I mean? Like that just such a crazy thing. And then we watched the fight. I was with Andrew from the Mac Life. I was with, David August, who designs all of his suits. It was like it was the friends and family section. So I was like, well, you know, I didn't belong there at all, but I wore my 3-piece suit. I was so nervous for the entire fight. I don't even really remember the fight. Cause I was like, please just win, please, whatever. And then as soon as Khabib jumps the cage, Connor's security turns to me. He's like, yeah, you should just get out of here. Brawls were erupting on the concourse. There's really just like one video that went viral of a concourse fight.
Yeah.
I saw that fight in person. I'm not in the video, but I was running and I just thought chaos was erupting everywhere. I don't think it was. I think it was just one fight. But I remember telling a concession worker on my way out, like, you got to get out of here. And she just laughed at me. She was like, ha, ha, ha. But yeah, that was really scary. And then after...
Hostile atmosphere, wasn't it?
Incredibly hostile. The entire week, the fight itself, incredibly hostile. And then afterwards, I sort of continued with like the antagonizing Khabib on the blog until I got even more death threats. And then I eventually just said, this isn't worth it. Like the, I guess, Dagestani sense of humor that Khabib has is probably not similar to my sense of humor, probably not similar to the Barstool sense of humor. No. So now I sort of keep his name off my lips. If Connor has a rematch with him though, oh Lord, forgive me. I might go back to the old me.
Well, that's, speaking of Connor, on the subject of the man himself, the third retirement tweet this week. What's your take on it? Because I know a lot of people have said, like, I know Joe Rogan in particular said that it's you know, it's not genuine. It's another kind of way of I suppose tricking the fans and boom, coming back out of nowhere.
I agree with him. Like as soon as I saw the tweet, it was right as I was going to bed. It was right as UFC 250 was over, right? Mm-hmm. So we were all like, all right, this is great. Like, what a great night of fights we just saw. Call it a night. Scrolling through my phone one last time, and I see another Conor McGregor retirement tweet. And I think my initial reaction was just like, Jesus Christ, like, are we doing this again? Like, it didn't even for a second make my heart skip a beat like the first two did, where it was like, wait a minute, what's Conor doing right now? It was just like, man, you can't do the retirement thing again. Like, if you're trying to negotiate in a different way, like, I get it, but don't do the retirement. Say, tweet, like, period at Bellator MMA. Just say that. And then everyone would be like, whoa, what's going on? You know, like, that would get people in a frenzy. But I feel like I had the same reaction as everyone, or just like, dude, you can't do the third retirement tweet in 4 years. Where it was almost worded the exact same way to like I've decided to retire young. There's nothing that interests me, with the picture of him and his mom with 10 watermarks over the whole thing. Where it's like, dude, what do you, I got the sense that he was almost trying to take the attention away from UFC 250, whether it was on purpose or not. And I think he definitely will be back. I don't think it was a genuine retirement. I think it's just what we've seen a lot of fighters going through recently. Probably A, either wants to get paid more, or B, he wants to fight right now. He's been saying he wants to fight. He wants to stay active. He's wanted the three fight season in 2020. And Dana White keeps saying, hey, there's nothing that makes sense for you right now. We'd rather you wait for Justin and Khabib to settle it. I don't know. I really, really don't believe that it's a real retirement. Like, there's no part of me, not an inch of my body, believes it's a real retirement.
But I mean, it came as a surprise to me, and it was kind of like, oh, you know, like you, it was the same. I had the same reaction as yourself. It was kind of like, this again. It's worded the exact same as the last two tweets. And I just think the build up as well to the fight with Cerrone, it was a stark reminder of the McGregor in 2015 and 2016 in terms of his build-up, in terms of where he was mentally at. Like, he was focused as fuck. And when he
sounded so good,
didn't he? When he is in that mode, there's no one that can stop him. He is like, he's unstoppable in that moment. He really is, like, you know, when he's in that zone. You know, there's no one that can take Conor McGregor, and it's never happened. He said in the past about the Nate Diaz fight, the first fight, he says the camp was a bit off. Same for the Khabib fight, he wasn't focused. Now he's in that period of time where he's completely focused on what's ahead of him. So it did come as a bit of a surprise in that sense, you know.
100%. You're preaching to the choir too, where that Cerrone fight feels like 100 years ago. That was this year, which is insane. But I think the combination of like the Corona hitting at the bad time that it did, where it, you know, if it didn't, like, we get Khabib and Tony, right? And then Justin Gaethje might just be available for McGregor. They might just fight and make that happen. But the combination of everything hitting in the way it did, just, it was like a perfect storm of things to screw up Conor McGregor's season, I guess. In terms of, like, the Masvidal thing doesn't really make sense right now. I'm sure if they tried to set that up, they would both be looking for a lot of money, and I don't know if the UFC has that money right now. I don't know if you want to put that fight on, not in front of fans either. Like, that's also one where, do you want Masvidal versus McGregor in an empty arena? I'm sure the pay-per-views would be amazing, but do you want to do that where you don't even get a press conference where they could sit next to each other and do the face-off? Come on. That's like, that's the one where you want to heighten all of the antics and you want to go all out for that. So I don't know what you do with Conor. I feel like there are names that can make sense. I feel like you can do the trilogy with Nate Diaz. Like, I don't know who wouldn't want to see that right now. I feel like Dustin Poirier, if you did a rematch with him at this stage, he's a different fighter than he was when Conor first fought.
Make a lot of sense.
Doing that not at featherweight, right? That immediately just makes it a different fight.
Yeah.
So that's what confuses me, where I feel like the fights are out there for him. He's saying there's nothing that excites me at this stage in the game. The Poirier fight makes sense to me. The Nate Diaz fight makes sense to me. He seemed like he wanted the Nate Diaz fight after the Cowboy fight. Someone asked him about it in the post-fight press conference, and he was like, let's go, Nathan, let's do it. You know, I'm always down for that. So there's where, like, my hesitation comes in, and I go, like, wait a minute. Like, why are you doing this? Was it just a spur of the moment? Like, you were upset at midnight or whatever as you were watching UFC, and you were like, screw it, I'm going to send this out to mess with Dana? I don't know.
Well, it's funny because John Jones is kind of in the exact same position. John Jones is thinking about that. On a tirade on Twitter, he's been ranting about the UFC not getting a piece of anything, not getting any share. You know, he's not happy at all.
Yeah, him and Masvidal too. Masvidal's been going off too, like saying, hey, why don't you release me from my contract if you're not paying me as well? I saw Dana went on ESPN earlier today, and he got into a huge argument with, I believe, the man, I forget his name, but he was the former president of the NFL Players Association. So he kind of dealt with, like, players unionizing and the way that players can get like a revenue split, a fair revenue split. Mm. And he started sort of like really pushing back on Dana. And oh my God, Dana hated it. And when I do my interviews with Dana, I always get shit from the MMA media where they say like, oh my God, you're a yes man. You're a bootlicker for him. You don't push back on him. And I always try to say this.
Tell them to fuck off.
Well, I tell them like, watch my interviews with everyone. I'm not a combative person. The goal of my show, my interviews, I always tell people this beforehand. I'm not trying to get crazy sound bites. I'm not trying to set up fights. Like, I'm literally just trying to have like a comfortable environment for people to laugh. More than anything, you know, Barstool, we're trying to get comedy. We're not a real site. What my interviews with Dana are closer to him going on like Jimmy Fallon than they are like him going on Ariel Helwani. I'm not looking for real in-depth, hey, why don't you pay the fighters 13% instead of 12%? Like, I'm just looking for him to be like Oscar De La Hoya is a goof. And I'm like, ha-ha, yeah.
But Robbie, it goes back to your kind of your personality and how when you were 13 years old, you were so persistent in getting into Barstool. You know, you were sending them emails. You were, you know, everything. You just tried. You got there in the end. And then when you got there, you saw the niche within the Barstool market that there was no MMA coverage. You covered that. And then kind of you've got the MMA coverage there. Well, Dana White, let's get an interview with Dana White. Let's get him. It was the first episode of your podcast, I believe, Dana White was.
Yeah, he was.
You get Dana White in the podcast. And then I seen a video, I retweeted the video a few weeks ago of him talking about the blackjack competition.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Brilliant video. But like, and I watched you in particular in that video. And like, Rob, you're a very young man. And to see how composed you were, like interviewing one of the most influential figures in sport at the very minute, it was incredibly impressive, man.
And I really appreciate you saying so.
Well, and that's why people are giving you shit, because they're fucking jealous. But that's it. You're in the UFC headquarters in Dana White's office, and you're having a chilled out interview with him. He's chilled out. You're chilled out. You know.
I think there definitely could be an aspect to that. I think it's that, and I think a big part of it is like a misunderstanding of what Barstool Sports is. I think people think that we're trying to be taken very seriously as like journalists, which is a huge misunderstanding of like our brand and what we're trying to do. We're making dick and fart jokes. That's like what we want to do.
But like that said, you're kind of appealing to the casual fan as well in that sense. You know, and I'm going to be honest, there's a lot of casual UFC fans.
I don't think that's a bad thing either.
It's not a bad thing at all. You know, you know, they want to either see John, if a John Jones fight is on, people will tune into BT Sport over here. If Amanda Nunes is on, they'll tune in. Masvidal, Nate Diaz, Khabib, Conor, the Cash Cow, Ronda Rousey. Like, these are the people that they want to tune into. And it does. It's the casual fan that has to be the target audience in that sense. You know, absolutely.
Yeah, and I love like appealing to the casual fan, and my favorite messages I get are the people that are like, hey man, I never watched UFC before I saw your stupid courthouse video, or I saw your like Connor, the next video, your Dana White interview. If people say I watched UFC for the first time and I enjoyed it because of that, man, that's like, that sends me over the moon. Because I'm like, Jesus Christ, like if I could get someone fascinated in something that I'm so passionate about legitimately as like I've been a diehard fan for a decade like you. So it's like that. Those are the messages where I'm like, all right, the haters are worth it for the people that I'm like introducing to the sport. That's really cool.
Absolutely, man. Absolutely. But look, listen, moving away from the MMA, how we first met was obviously through a little wrestling event called WrestleMania 2 years ago. What's your? I do see some of your tweets, and you are. I think you're very honest in your tweets about the current state of the product of the WWE and of course AEW. What's your view on everything that's happening now? Of course, they're limited with the pandemic going on. You know, with the empty arena in Florida.
Man, right now I've been a wrestling fan for as long as I can remember. Like wrestling got me into MMA, like I said, and I don't remember a time in my life where I didn't love wrestling. My older brother is a massive wrestling fan. So he got me into it through like the golden age of WWF. Hulk Hogan, Ultimate Warrior, like WrestleMania 6 was like my literally, I watched the VHS every single day as a Warrior fan. So I was really excited about the outcome there. And right now I feel like wrestling as a whole is probably the talent crop that across the entire like industry as good as it's ever been. But so many of those people are being underutilized, specifically in the WWE, that like I am a little bit disenfranchised with the WWE. I have been loving AEW. I think it's such a great alternative, and I think it's such a great just like breath of fresh air. Every time I watch it, there are segments where it feels like, hey, maybe Jericho's going off the cuff here. Like maybe this is just bullet points. Maybe Ambrose is going off the cuff here. Or I'll watch a Young Bucks, Kenny Omega, Hangman Page match. That'll just like blow me away. And I'm like, man, they would probably never give them that time in WWE. So I don't want to say that I'm anti-WWE by any means, because they'll always be like the first company I loved. I have never missed a WrestleMania since WrestleMania 19. That was my first. And I've always watched every single one since. I've got friends in the company there. But right now, I feel like the main, like, overall broad strokes, what do you think about wrestling? I think AEW is doing a really good job at becoming what they've set out to be, like an alternative program. And WWE is sort of like sinking. And I know the pandemic is not making it easier for them, but I don't think interest in wrestling has gone down in the pandemic. No. Like Dark Side of the Ring, the Vice series, just saw that. That was like Vice's highest rated series they ever put out during the pandemic.
I watched the Chris Benoit episode, and I watched the Jimmy Snuka one. There's a couple I want to watch as well.
Dude, it's heavy. It's tough to watch, but it's well made.
The Schultz episode here is brilliant, and the Owen Hart episode.
Yes, the Owen Hart episode is for like me. It was so tough to watch because there's a lot of details that I didn't know. They had, you know, Owen's whole family are talking about the incident and Owen as a person. So it's like tough to watch, but very informative and very well made. So you see like, okay, that does the highest ratings that any show's ever done for Vice, and WWE's ratings for now, like pretty a long time, years, have been steady decline. What's going on there? That being said, WWE also has their high points. NXT, love NXT.
Yeah.
Absolutely adore it. Like 100%. I think Triple H knows what he's doing there. I think the talent crop there is being utilized great. They just had In Your House. I didn't see the entire thing. I saw bits and pieces of it. Loved the main event. I thought that was great. Io winning the title is a great move. Finn Balor going back down there, I think, is cool. Like breath of fresh air, like I said. Velveteen Dream down there is great. Matt Riddle, who just got called up, was great for so long down there. Adam Cole, again, the entire Undisputed Era. So I definitely don't think, like, some people call me like a Debbie Downer when it comes to the WWE. I don't try to be that at all. But right now I would say I'm way more interested in the product that AEW is putting on.
100%. And I think the issue, and it's been a longstanding issue with the WWE for years now, is that as soon as WrestleMania season finishes, obviously it's expected that the ratings are going to drop and drop and drop and drop and drop for the May pay-per-view. They can't seem to keep that momentum after WrestleMania. It just drops.
Isn't it so weird? Because I feel like, you'll know this as a wrestling fan, Backlash used to be like a massive pay-per-view after WrestleMania. It used to be, we would be getting like half the card would probably be WrestleMania rematches. And then you would get like whoever the babyface that won the championship in the main event would get his first big like monster heel challenger or something. Like Backlash used to be awesome.
If you want a perspective on Backlash and WrestleMania, all you have to do is look at WrestleMania 16 from 2000 and Backlash 2000. Backlash 2000 was more memorable than the actual.
It's a better show.
It was a better show, and I think it was down to the fact that Austin came out and Rock finally won the title from the McMahon-Helmsley faction. And then it's crazy. A month later, they have Judgment Day, where Taker comes out as the American Badass. You know, listen, I know that it's very difficult for them to replicate any kind of, you know, any kind of storylines like that nowadays. But if they could get back to that, what they need to achieve is to keep those ratings going. Like, keep those WrestleMania season ratings going after WrestleMania's finished, and not have such a massive decline.
And we would even hear, like, I feel like going into 2011, the summer of punk, right, was awesome. Yeah, but even that, like, there was such a weird period of time between that and WrestleMania 27. WrestleMania 27, which Punk was on the undercard of and the Miz main event, right? Where they put CM Punk in, like, charge of the new Nexus, and they did that weird promo where he was, like, going to commit suicide on top of the Titantron. He was threatening it. Yeah. And I was like, what are you doing? Like, weeks before the Summer of Punk kicked in, it was, like you said, that low period where they were just like, eh, it's fine. Ratings go down anyway. Where I don't know why they settle for that. I think it probably comes down to Vince being out of touch, because when you look at the product that NXT puts on, there are those sort of moments where the crowd goes insane over the tiniest stuff, right? And it's like, oh man, like, they sort of get it there. Remember War Games when Kevin Owens came back last November? War Games. What a moment that was. Like,
huge.
If that would have, I don't remember the last moment we got like that on main roster TV or like a pay-per-view like that. Literally can't recall it, but NXT, it came to mind like that for me, where I was like, oh yeah, War Games, like Kevin Owens come back. Yeah. That was amazing.
Yeah, it was. It was a huge pop. And obviously, I mean, I sensed that there was a slight turning point from the Royal Rumble this year. I think Vince, well, I don't know if Vince is listening, but they were listening to the fans in terms of Drew winning the Rumble, because Drew McIntyre was on the back a couple of months, and I had noticed a few weeks prior to the Royal Rumble they were really pushing him, and he was getting a lot. He was getting more time on the mic. He was really showcasing his mic skills, and we know what he's like in the ring. He's for a big guy. I mean, he is phenomenal in the ring. So we get to the Royal Rumble. Drew wins it. Edge comes back, which I think is.
Well, there you go. That was a big moment. Yeah.
Huge moment. I think the best return since the Hardys in WrestleMania 33.
Gives me like chills, literally, just talking about it.
And I think that, as you said, I think it's like with everything, the pandemic hit and that kind of aura from WrestleMania was taken away. Like, there were some fantastic matches on the card. Edge Orton, Drew Brock.
Yeah,
I'm not going to say Roman and Goldberg. And I like Roman.
Owens and Rollins was even good. Imagine what it could have been if they had that in front of a crowd.
Well, didn't Kevin Owens say, he saw this sign. He said my original idea for the elbow drop was to jump off the fucking pirate ship.
Oh my God. As a friend of his, I'm like, why? Don't do that. That thing was like 40 feet high. He's a lunatic. He took that crazy bump of Money in the Bank too. And Braun Strowman like threw him off that ladder on this stage. Dude's becoming like a Shane McMahon. Dude, what are you doing? He's the best though. He really is.
He's great, man. He is. Yeah. Whether heel or face, he can do both. I mean,
he gets it.
And I really do hope, they need to give him a good title run. Maybe as a face, they need to give him the title run that he deserves. I think it's heading that way, especially after beating Rollins at WrestleMania.
And he could be like a good anti-authority figure. He was that in Ring of Honor with Jim Cornette, and it was like really, really good the way he had that anti-authority Stone Cold type thing. I know it's like the... Everyone gets compared to Stone Cold, even when Becky Lynch was doing her man stuff. Yeah. Is Becky Lynch the new Stone Cold? Is this the new Stone Cold? But he had a bit of that vibe, and he's doing the stunner now too, which there you go.
It's funny you say that about Austin. There is always a comparison. Oh, he's the new Stone Cold. I mean, they're saying
you
they
see it with about, Moxley in AEW.
They said it about Randy Orton in 2010. Yeah, I remember they said he's the new Stone Cold Steve Austin. I think they said it about Brock at one point as well.
Yeah. I'm sure people said it about Daniel Bryan and his anti-authority angle of, oh my God, he's the most over guy since Austin, which he probably was at that point.
That storyline was incredible. And it goes back
That's my favorite storyline in the history of wrestling. As a guy, I was a fan of Daniel Bryan like on the indies. So he felt like he was the first guy for me that ever felt like he was like my guy that rose to prominence, the underground band that you watch blow up. And the main event of WrestleMania 30, my favorite match ever. I understand it's overbooked with the way they bring the stretcher out, they bring the crooked referee out.
I know, it was great.
Dude, I love it. I think it's like a 27-minute match, and the way you could just you could show that to a non-wrestling fan and they would understand the entire like 9 month storyline leading up to that just through that one match. I love that match. Can't say enough good things about it.
Yeah, it was an incredible match. And it was the lift that the fans needed.
From the streak. After the streak. Oh.
But the streak, I loved the booking of the streak, you know, because
now that they did it, I mean, it's the most shocking moment in wrestling history. Nothing will ever top it.
Nothing. No, I don't think anything will ever top that. I mean, it's a testament to the man himself. I mean, going that long, and it's crazy to see him still going.
I wish he would stop, though. The Goldberg match in Saudi Arabia?
Yeah.
Oh, my God, Al.
You know what? If he's competing next year, it's in Hollywood.
Do the Boneyard shit. That was awesome.
Just do it. Yeah.
Did you like the cinematic stuff?
I loved it.
The Funhouse too.
Oh, the Funhouse was fucking amazing.
Oh, I'm glad you liked that too. Yeah, because I saw some people that like some wrestling fans, they were like, this spit in the face of wrestling, whatever. I felt like that was making the best out of pandemic. That and the stadium matches that AEW does. Those are great too. Oh. Like cinematic wrestling is so much fun.
I mean, Sammy Guevara taking that bump. I mean,
and the horse coming in, Adam Page coming in on the horse. Tremendous, tremendous.
But that's what we love about wrestling. You have to love the ridiculousness of it as well.
Yeah. Totally. That's like what I got into. Look at early 90s wrestling. Every gimmick was just a job. It was like the big boss man was a cop. It was like the Nails was a prisoner. Brutus the Barber Beefcake was just a barber. Everyone just had a job.
Yeah. Sergeant Slaughter was a sergeant.
Yeah, he recruited people to the military. Okay, like fine.
Oh man, it's amazing. But that is I've been following wrestling since the Attitude. I got in on the Attitude Era and just... ever since then. I mean, a couple of my mates just grown out of it and I've just never stopped. I don't know.
I'm the same way growing up. Like when you get to that seventh, eighth grade part where everyone's just like, that's lame, it's fake. You're like, you knew it was fake when you liked it 2 years ago. Why don't you like it now? And yeah, you gotta start hiding your wrestling figures away from people. Yeah.
Oh, stop. But,
we've all been there.
But, no, I mean, obviously, you're a huge wrestling fan, and it is. It's great. I love talking to people about wrestling. I really do. It's just
me too.
It's something I could talk about for hours and hours.
I always say, and this isn't like my quote. I think many people have said this, but when wrestling is at its best, nothing in the world is better. Like when you're in the middle of a WrestleMania crowd and everyone's going crazy, popping for the same thing, and everyone's just lost in the moment. Like you're not even thinking about whether or not what you're watching is real, fake, scripted. Yeah. You're not thinking about the personalities, the backstage politics. When you could just get caught up in that, Batista's tapping out, Miracle on Bourbon Street, you know, Daniel Bryan. There's nothing better.
When I was at WrestleMania 34, we hooked up with Finn Balor, and Finn brought us backstage. He brought me and my friend Greg backstage, and we're there meeting Ronda Rousey. Charlotte Flair's in front of us. We see John Cena.
You're just floating on a cloud from each and every person.
It's something I'll never forget.
Yeah.
And he was so casual about it. He brought us over to the catering end. Like, do you just want something to eat there? There's yogurts there. And we're like, no, we're fine. They've been working hard all night. Let them have it.
And he was in that. He was in a fucking great match that night that opened the show. The Intercontinental match that people don't talk about that anymore. Great WrestleMania opening match. Like talk about set the tone for the night. Yeah, that was really good.
With Seth winning the title. Finn is just Fergal. He's an absolute gentleman, man. He is so.
Dude, I've never met him. Every single person that I know that knows him through, some people, even John Cadmo, I've talked about, knows him through, I guess he's trained at SBG before. Yeah. But through wrestling, everyone says he's like the best guy in the world.
He's just an absolute gent. And like such a happy person, constantly happy.
Loves his Legos. I remember seeing his documentary. He's just like, oh yeah, I love my Legos. I go home after the matches, I build my Lego sets. Just like, what a guy. How do you not love a guy like that?
For him to do that, for us, like it was the last thing we expected. And I remember he asked where we were sitting, where our section was, and he got a guy to go out from to go out and seek us out, and he brought us backstage, and we were just we were pissed as well. We were fucking
hey, it's WrestleMania. You gotta live it up, right? Like tomorrow's never guaranteed.
I've never been more tired after an event, Robbie.
Hey, you want to know something funny about that WrestleMania? Is I was there with Pat, right? And so Pat at the time was working for Barstool and WWE. Now he doesn't work for Barstool.
Oh, by the way, Pat was backstage as well.
Yeah, so that's what I'm getting to, is Pat is in a three-piece suit, right? Because he did some kind of pre-show, something for NXT, I think. And he got to come out, though, for the show. Once the show started, his duties were over. They didn't need him anymore. He got to come out and sit with us. We were sitting amazing seats, thanks to the WWE and Pat's connection, right by the entranceway. So when Braun Strowman is looking for a tag team partner, and he eventually selected Nicholas, he came out to the crowd and started walking so close to us that, Al, I swear to you, me and everyone around Pat were so, we were like, did Pat somehow kayfabe us? Is he making his debut at WrestleMania? And Pat, and we were all like silent because we were like, we don't want to ruin the moment and ask him. And Pat was silent because in his own head, and I don't know why he would ever think this is not the way wrestling works. He was like, oh no, I hope Braun doesn't pick me. He thought Braun was just going to come out and be like, get in the ring in his three-piece suit. So we had such a funny moment like in that exchange where he picked Nicholas. And of all of us being like, is Pat about to make a WWE debut?
Brilliant.
That was ridiculous. That, and we got to see Daniel Bryan's return was that night. And I was like standing on my chair the entire time, just losing my mind. And on the broadcast, you could see me throughout like the entire match. If you go back and watch it, there's just a lunatic standing on his chair, very much treating this wrestling match like it's game 7 of the World Series. I think I cried when he won too. I think I like hugged Pat and cried in joy.
Brilliant. Oh man, there's nothing beats it. Obviously, look, I want to move on to another note of yours on Star Wars. I think you're a bigger Star Wars fan than you are a wrestling fan.
I got the lightsaber on the arm.
Yeah, man. Like I've seen, you met Mark Hamill as well at the Star Wars convention.
No, so that was like the most spur of the moment thing too. That was at Good Morning America, and I had a friend working at Good Morning America. He ran their social media at the time, and now he works at Barstool. His name's Jeff Lowe. He does all of our like movie content. So if you see any of the lights, camera, Barstool stuff, that's him now. Mm. But he worked at Good Morning America at the time, and we had met at a Star Wars convention. Mm. Both huge Star Wars fans. He was a bit of a Barstool fan, so he knew the content, and we just got friendly that way. And he said, hey man, Mark Hamill's coming to promote The Last Jedi at the end of November. Like, I could put you in the audience if you'd like. And I was like, man, like, obviously a Star Wars fan like me, just being in like the presence of Mark Hamill would be amazing. So he gets me the ticket or whatever at a Good Morning America. I'm not sure exactly how it works because I think you usually apply for those, but there's such funny videos because Margot Robbie was promoting I, Tonya at the time too. So the entire crowd was just women and it was me. I was the only guy. So like there's videos of like Margot Robbie and like the Good Morning America cast and I'm just like sitting there in my stupid backwards hat, right? But It got pushed at the last minute and they were like, okay, we're going to push it. Mark Hamill's supposed to be there on say Tuesday and he wound up showing up on Friday. So I had a tattoo appointment scheduled for the lightsaber on my arm on like Thursday. So I was like, oh my God, this is going to work out perfectly. Like what if Mark Hamill, you know, God willing, catches it out of the corner of his eye. Like, is that a lightsaber tattoo on that guy? It's Luke's lightsaber, right? And as soon as I get to Good Morning America, that's pretty much what happens. Not Mark Hamill that notices it, but I think it was Michael Strahan and like a few other people noticed it. And they were like, is that a lightsaber? And I was like, yeah. And they were like, all right, we're going to do a segment for you. And they said, we're going to have a surprise for you. And I knew it was probably going to be like Mark Hamill because I knew he was on the show that day, but I didn't say anything. And on live TV, they were like, everyone like look, it's Robbie and he's got a Star Wars tattoo. And I was like, oh my God, I show it off, right? Like I look like an idiot because I'm all flustered on TV. My heart's racing, right? And then Mark Hamill walks into the room and I met him for 2 seconds. It was the picture that is my profile picture that will never change. I'll never change that. It's the greatest picture I'll ever take.
Awesome, man.
It was, that's pretty much all it was. They brought me over. They were like, Mark, look, he's got a lightsaber tattoo. And he was like, hey, let's take a picture. And he was the one immediately that went in and grabbed it. Like, I didn't even say like, hey, want to take a picture? Like you're holding the lightsaber. He grabbed it. And the funniest part is I got the tattoo the day before. So it was fresh. And oh man, Al, that hurts. Oh. I had to sort of hold that in, right? As Luke Skywalker is holding my arm. I'm like, ah! And then like I do that stupid face that you see in my picture. And that was that. And he posted it on his Instagram later that day and said something like, what a committed Star Wars fan. The least I could do if he got that tattoo is to wield it myself. So he put like Luke Skywalker posting a picture of me and him on his Instagram. That was like the greatest moment of my life, maybe.
That's incredible.
Yeah, and I always say, since it was healing at the time that he grabbed it, I always like to imagine that there's still some Mark Hamill DNA left in there.
Absolutely, man. Like, I'm obviously, what were your views? I know you're very, you had a positive attitude towards the sequels where a lot of people didn't.
Yeah.
A lot of people aggressively didn't, though. I mean... you know, there's a point you can be diplomatic about the movie and not be so aggressive. Like I've seen some of the Star Wars fans go after that actress Kelly Marie Tran.
Man, that's crazy.
And it was absolutely shocking. You know?
It's insane because it's like they didn't learn their lessons from the prequel trilogy as a fan base where people went after Jake Lloyd like that when he was such a little kid in The Phantom Menace. And listen, trust me, I'm a massive Star Wars fan. I can acknowledge that the prequels are pretty shitty movies, but I love them. They're like, they're the movies I grew up with, right? Oh yeah. I mean, yeah. Big jump in quality there, but they went after Jake Lloyd like that. They went after Ahmed Best, who played Jar Jar Binks like that. And he just recently came out in the past few years and talked about what a tough time he went through because of that and how like dark his thoughts got because of that. And he's now being brought back into the Star Wars universe, which I think is awesome. They're going to have him host a Legends of the Hidden Temple type Star Wars show that they're describing as, which Legends of the Hidden Temple, talk about another great show.
But actor should say that. No actor should come out.
I know.
I got cast in Star Wars and it was one of the worst periods of my life.
And it's like, it's you want to say it's not even their fault, but even saying that feels like it gives the people saying such hateful stuff reason to say it, like it was someone's fault. These movies for me, the sequel trilogy, if you don't like the movies, that's fine. I could see why. They were very disjointed, right? They didn't have a lot of planning going through the all three. They have their flaws. I get it. For me, I watched these movies and I watched the documentaries they made about the making of the movies. And I very much get the sense that they were made out of love and they were made with the intention of Star Wars fans loving them. They were... A lot of people that go at these movies maliciously say like, Disney ruined it. They're a cash cow. They ruined my childhood for a couple bucks. I think, of course, Disney's trying to make money. They bought Star Wars for $4 billion. They want to make that money back, which they already have.
Oh, hang on a second. So I say to these people, did Disney ruin your comic book adaptations with the Marvel Cinematic Universe?
Exactly. Exactly. Like the Disney-fying Star Wars. I've never understood that. As if Disney makes bad content. Disney is like infamous for making awesome stuff. Disney Pixar. Like, has there been one bad Disney Pixar movie ever? Like,
My daughter, it's either Finding Nemo or Cars. Cars, surprisingly, she loves it. She's 15 months old. But I put on Finding Nemo. I put on the intro to that. And the visuals of...
The bright colors,
The bright colors. She is just... She's clapping her hands. Even when she sees the Pixar lamp jumping up and down, she actually motions in the exact same way the lamp is jumping.
Dude, it's insane. I've got a nephew who's about to turn 6 and a niece who just turned 2. And they're also obsessed with Toy Story 4. The level at which Disney has it down, we buy her a fork. There's a character named Forky. It's a it's a disposable fork. It's her favorite thing in the entire world.
If I could get it now, I actually have Forky. We have a Forky.
Of course you do. Of course you do. They got to figure it out. They put a pipe cleaner around a fork, and literally it's like every child in the world's favorite thing. As if Disney makes bad things. Like, so yeah, I love the sequel trilogy. Like I said, they felt like movies made out of love to me. Yeah. I really love the Ray character. My niece is named Harley Ray, and my nephew is actually named Luke. So that shows you how far Star Wars runs in my entire family. Wow. But it also felt like, you know, like my trilogy in a way, because I was born in a weird time for Star Wars in that I sort of caught the tail end of the prequel trilogy in theaters. I saw Revenge of the Sith. I think I saw Attack of the Clones in theaters, but I was like one when Phantom Menace came out. So getting to speculate about each and every movie with fans and getting to watch the trailers and watch every trailer as it came out and getting to see, oh my God, like there's a new promotional standee in a Target that excites me, you know, like the tiny stuff like that.
Or even in Times Square.
Completely.
You see those billboards in Times Square.
Seeing the advertisements on the top of taxi cabs, like that would like make me excited. Like, oh my God, they're promoting a new Star Wars movie. We're about to see a new star. Like, what is the lightsaber fight going to be like? What is John Williams' score going to be like? Yeah. Getting to have that through three movies, getting to have the moments like Han coming into the Falcon with the Chewie, we're home, getting to have like all of that stuff, man. Like, I loved it. I don't think I'll ever look back at this trilogy with anything but like great memories and nostalgia from the time. Like, I saw all of these movies a ridiculous amount of times in theaters too. Like, I saw Force Awakens, I think 5 times in theaters, Last Jedi 7, Rise of Skywalker 4 or 5. Like, I'm just a nut about Star Wars, and even the spinoffs too. People said, oh my God, Disney ruined Star Wars. How do you not like Rogue One?
Rogue One's incredible.
Like, I could see not liking Solo. I'm not the biggest fan myself. I very much a Harrison Ford guy.
I didn't think it was that bad.
I didn't think it was horrible. I think it's very much okay. But Rogue One was like, that Darth Vader scene is some of the best stuff we've ever seen in any Star Wars movie ever.
That sequence, the ending sequence just kind of, you know, seamlessly going into the start of A New Hope was just, that's
so good.
That was fucking amazing.
Like, how could you watch that and then ask for more as a Star Wars fan, or say that Disney doesn't know what they're doing, or even watch The Mandalorian? How do you know The Mandalorian?
I am intrigued with the direction they're going to take Star Wars now. Now that the Skywalker saga is over, I mean, you've got The Mandalorian season 2. I believe Jon Favreau they've put him kind of in he has a creative role now within Star Wars. You know, leading up to the future, but in terms of new projects, whatever, series like The Mandalorian. I heard The Mandalorian was kind of, it's his kind of baby in a sense.
Oh yeah.
That's, you know, if that's what's to come, then it's a very exciting time. It's a new and exciting time to be a Star Wars fan.
Definitely. It's him and Dave Filoni who did the Clone Wars. Obviously, he's like a Star Wars encyclopedia, sort of the heir to George Lucas, everyone said. If you put those two in the Kevin Feige type role of the MCU, where Kevin Feige has laid the blueprint out, right? The Infinity Saga is over. 100%. He's put out 22 movies that were perfect. Talk about like pitching a perfect storyline, perfect game. The blueprint's out, and I don't even think you have to do it in movies. I think, like you said, if the new direction is you do TV and you put Jon Favreau and Dave Filoni at the helm, where you just make sure that they keep the ducks in a line and make sure that, hey, the sequel trilogy, we ran into a few issues here, here, and here with not planning. So let's make sure we never do that again, and let's just expand upon like the universe that we've built. The universe that they built in The Mandalorian, it was the coolest like world building we've seen in Star Wars since the prequels, for sure. Like, I love the sequels, but it was very much all based on nostalgia and stuff we've seen before.
It's a Star Wars Western. That's what it is.
And it really plays that way. I love the serial aspect of it, where not every episode connects. You could show someone episode 6 and they'd be fine. They would get it, right? You could show someone episode 3 where he goes back for the baby. It's all you need to know. You don't need to see him get the baby in the first episode. But if you pay attention in every episode, it pays off. And by the finale, you know, everything is adding up and falling into place perfectly. And you're like, oh shit, like IG-11 couldn't self-destruct in the first episode, but now they're tying up that loose end and he's doing it to finish. So like that. And then, I mean, you can't talk about The Mandalorian without mentioning the adorableness of Baby Yoda. He's maybe my favorite person in the world. I would die for him in this moment. I bought the $400 replica, life-size replica of Baby Yoda the second it went on sale, but Corona delayed it to August. So that is really my biggest gripe with this whole pandemic. I'm like, give me my Baby Yoda.
Oh, God, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, but that, and then even, I don't know if you've been watching the gallery episodes they've put on Disney Plus. It's kind of the behind the scenes. So they've been doing like 20, 30 minute behind the scenes episodes for each episode of The Mandalorian, focusing on a different aspect. So one's about the directors, one's about the cast, one's about the special effects. And they have been incredible. Like, it's the kind of stuff that inspires you to be creative in a completely different like realm. You know, it might inspire you to go like learn a new impression, seeing someone render a new background. Like, it's just this sort of stuff where these people are so inspired and so passionate about what they're doing that it's like infectious.
That's the beauty of filmmaking in that sense, in being creative, coming up with these new ideas and being there on hand. Like, I studied film production in college. I did it, I graduated from it. When you study film, it's kind of like, you know, when you study medicine and your aim is to become a doctor, you know, you get there in the end. But when you study film and you finish up, it's not as if you're going to be, you know, directing the next James Bond movie. It's not that sense.
Although I'll tell you what, I would definitely watch like a James Bond movie directed by Al, where Al plays all of the parts. even the like the damsel in distress, you throw a wig on. Oh my God, I would be down for that.
Do you know what? The only way I'd do it is I'd actually have to impersonate all six James Bonds.
All of the different Bonds? You do a Connery? You got to have a Connery, right? Everyone does?
There's a Connery to everyone, absolutely.
You got it. That's like the ABCs. That's like a car. You got to learn Stairway, right?
Yeah, absolutely, man.
It's like Connery walking. Yeah.
And obviously, I am. You're of course, you're a huge MCU fan. Who isn't? And I'll never forget the video of your reaction after Avengers Endgame. I'll never forget seeing that video.
Crying my eyes out, man.
It's a little different over in Ireland. We're a little more conservative in the cinema when we go cinema in the movies when we see a movie. But Avengers Endgame was an exception. It was the best movie experience I've ever had, because when I went to see it, I saw it opening night, me and my younger brother, and people were cheering as fuck. That scene, I could hear people. It was like I was watching a football match. It was like someone scored.
Yes.
You know, and when Cap wields.
That's what we said the same thing. It felt like we were in an arena, and our setup for Avengers Endgame was like, again, the best movie experience I've ever had as well, because we had, I think, 15, like a group of 15. We had a guy like purchase a bunch of seats all in the same area in the biggest IMAX theater in New York, in Lincoln Square. So we have like, there's literally hundreds of people in this theater, massive screen, right? And everyone sort of knew, like, the people in the group that cared way more about it than this more casual MCU fan. So we all sat together in our little corner and we were all gossiping. And when, you know, they have a crazy throwback, or when they showed the old Ant-Man helmet from the comics and something little like that, we're all like giggling like schoolgirls, right? And by the end of it, I realized that some of my friends' girlfriends had brought tissues along, but not for themselves, for me. They knew I was going to be a mess at the end of it, because I cry at everything, man. I'm one of these guys, and I'm not ashamed of it. I'm like, what? Hey, I can't help it. I can't.
No,
I watch Disney,
all.
Disney, Pixar, Onward. I'm a mess. I'm a puddle.
Absolutely. Toy Story 4. Myself and my girlfriend went to see Toy Story. We brought Sophia. Sophia was maybe 3 months old. She slept throughout the whole movie. We had to see it because it was our childhood. And
of course.
The two of us.
I was watching that and I was like, I don't even think kids are going to understand this. Like,
no.
You know what I mean? Like,
it was when he hugged Buzz.
But for me, it's like everything about that finishing sequence of Endgame, particularly the speech that Tony Stark leaves as they show the montage of the world going back to normal. oh my God, that gets me. And then the ending where they give Cap his happy ending and he gives man, no, I don't think I will. Oh my God, everything about it was just like they stuck the landing. Like I remember we kept saying that, like it's what it felt like. It was like, I can't believe like they did it. It felt like if Endgame was a bad movie, right? It puts kind of a weird tone on the entire MCU. Oh my God, the pressure, I can't even imagine. We're in quarantine. I'm sure you've seen on your Twitter, every single show of all time is being rewatched. I haven't seen one tweet about someone rewatching Game of Thrones.
No. And I hate hearing that because seasons 1 to 7 is just, it's masterpiece television. Michael Bisping was looking for recommendations and I recommended True Detective season 1 only.
I did that for the first time in quarantine. Literally 2-3 weeks ago, I think. Al, I don't know if I've ever been more blown away. I finished it, and I heard the same thing that you just said, where season 2 and 3, not really worth digging into. So as soon as I finished it, I was like, I might just restart it. I might watch the entire series over again because it was perfect. That one shot that everyone had talked about for years, I had heard like, man, there's a really intense one shot. Once you get to it, I was like, oh my God, I'm in it. I was like holding on like I was in a roller coaster.
That is the greatest piece of television I have ever watched, period. To think that, 6 months prior to that episode being released, the Breaking Bad finished up, and that Ozymandias episode came out. Like,
that's my favorite show ever, Breaking Bad.
Yeah, it's incredible. Yeah, it's the gold standard, isn't it?
It's a guy that knew like exactly when to call it quits, right? Like he knew the story. So many of these shows, I don't know if it's the Game of Thrones issue, because they really did need like an ending of that, or we needed someone on the throne. But the people that stretch these shows out and milk them, like The Walking Dead. I was such a big fan of The Walking Dead for a couple seasons. And now it's like, it's still on the air. People still watch it.
I know your pain, man. I actually stopped watching even before Negan came into it.
I stopped watching when Negan showed up because Glenn was my guy. No, you know, spoilers for 10 years ago if you're rewatching that. But as soon as Glenn was gone, I was like, I don't know if I could stick around. He was my guy.
No, it just got too messy.
Way and repetitive.
Too much expansion. I'm repetitive,
It was just like, we moved to a new place. These people that were nice aren't what they seem to be. All right, we need to find a new place, zombies.
The acting was a little bit forced.
Yeah. And that's a show, too, where you watch the first season of that show, and it's mind-blowing how good it is. But then after that, it's like, it had its moments afterwards. I remember, like, certain episodes in the prison, certain episodes in the barn when they have the little girl comes out of the barn. That was, like, a big moment. But
But it's Shane
just kind of faded away.
Shane and the Governor were the intriguing antagonists.
Yes.
Now, John Bernthal, incredible.
Awesome. And talk about a guy I'd like to see in the MCU. I know he showed interest as well.
He's very
good. I'd watch him play anything.
Yeah, absolutely, man. On the MCU, of course, you know, DC tried to counter that, obviously, and it just was... I knew it was going to be a failure. It was just massively rushed.
So rushed.
I mean, the movie I've been waiting for my whole life was Batman v Superman. It was a case of when with me at that point. And when it was announced, I was like, this is it. It's going to, you know, I'm finally going to see this on the big screen. Bit of a bummer.
I feel like I'm an apologist for that. Like, and almost, I want to say almost the DCEU. I'm not one of these Snyder Cut guys that believes like the Snyder Cut of Justice League is going to be some amazing movie. I also don't think Batman vs. Superman is an amazing movie. But I do think like there's moments in it. It was just good enough for me to like really wish it were better. And like that is like what hurt the most. And tell you a funny story about seeing that movie. I was working at a movie theater at the time that it came out, and we had like an option. We had to work the night it came out, but if you wanted to see it so it didn't get spoiled for you, you could go the night before and see it at 3 a.m. They would open up the theater at 3 a.m. and I did it. And that movie was so fucking long that I wound up having to drive straight from the movie theater just to school the next day, like high school. And it was not worth it for Batman versus Superman. I wish it, like, I remember sitting in homeroom just like falling asleep being like, I just wish the movie were better.
But that's the thing. I think it was the pressure on filmmakers and the producers to
It's like, I didn't hate Ben Affleck.
No, I didn't hate him either.
I like Jeremy Irons a lot as Alfred. Yeah, I thought he was great.
I like Henry Cavill. I think Henry Cavill.
So do I.
I think he is the comic book Superman in that sense.
But why don't they let him smile, Al? Why they make Henry Cavill, the only time they did let him smile was when they edited out his mustache and it looked all bizarre. Yeah.
when I went to see that, that was the first thing I saw.
That first shot, I know. It's just like, oh man, quivering lip Cavill.
I know. And after Justice League, I thought there's no direction for these guys. They have to boom, reboot, start all over again, and they have to build their own universes. And it brings me to the Batman next year. You've got an incredible director behind it in Matt Reeves.
Agreed. I
mean, the most underrated trilogy of all time is the Planet of the Apes trilogy.
Yes.
It is so fucking good.
Shout out Churnin Entertainment. That's the company that bought Barstool made those out.
Oh, man. Well,
what a great plug. You didn't even know it.
I didn't even know it. I agree. On here. It doesn't matter. Incredible trilogy, man.
I agree. I love those movies. All three of them are awesome. Then talk about a theater going experience. The first one, when Caesar first drops that no for the first time, like you could hear a pin drop, gasps everywhere, right? Yeah. So I love Matt Reeves. I'm very excited. I also love Robert Pattinson. I know people were kind of like back and forth about him at first, but you watch The Lighthouse, you watch Good Time, you watch really any of the movies he's been in since the Twilight movies, which are the ones that people know him.
I'm trying to convince my girlfriend. I remember telling her, I said, Robert Pattinson is playing Batman. And she went, what? I said, no. You've got to watch his body of work after Twilight up until now.
Yes.
You've got to watch it. Because,
incredible. You know, the tweets that were like, that said, oh, you cast a millionaire that has a bit of a dark side as Batman. Like, that's a real stretch. That is Robert Pattinson. Like, he's a millionaire. And it's like, yeah, he seems like a bit of a weird guy at times. Mm. That's kind of Bruce Wayne, isn't it? Like,
it is Bruce Wayne. 100%.
Perfect.
I'm so excited.
I love the guy they cast. I forget his name, but the guy they cast as Commissioner Gordon. Fucking awesome. He's in the second Hunger Games movie.
Jeffrey Lewis.
He's awesome in that movie. Yeah. And like a very Commissioner
Westworld.
Gordon.
He's Westworld.
Yes. And he always plays like the smart character. I can completely see him giving Batman like, you know, oh, here's the next villain or whatever. The Batmobile looks sick, that right? Looks like the muscle car Batmobile. Yeah. The fact that it's taking place in the 90s. And you're a comic book reader,
that's
right?
That's it, man. And that's
you've heard the rumors amazing. About the Long Halloween, have you not?
I have heard, well, it's been released.
If they do the Long Halloween, like...
Yeah.
That's the best prime Batman story ever for me is the Long Halloween in the comics. Like my favorite comic is Dark Knight Returns, but that's obviously like a bit of an out there, like Batman aging in his.
It's different. Yeah.
Different. Main Batman prime. Long Halloween shows like the detective side of Batman, the world's greatest detective. That's Batman.
Yeah, it is. 100% that's Batman. And I think the casting as well has been like Paul Dano as the Riddler.
Paul Dano as the Riddler. Zoe Kravitz is Catwoman. Selina Kyle.
And our very own Colin Farrell as the Penguin. That excites me. That really does excite me. And Andy Serkis is Alfred.
Dude, the entire Rogues Gallery that they're going through is like an all-star cast. This feels like what DC needed to do in the first place. Just like focus on making a great movie and then... The universe could come later. Like, I'm pretty sure with this one, there's no connected universe, right? They're saying like, no, we're just making a Batman movie.
No.
If something comes of it in the future, great.
Great.
That's what you got to do. Just make a good movie first.
There's no point in, there's no point in expanding it. And also, listen, the Dark Knight trilogy is my holy, but like, the Dark Knight's my holy Bible in terms of films. I love it so much. But, and there's a big but to those movies, and it's not a criticism whatsoever. It was just Nolan's creative process of making those movies. They were extremely realistic, and they weren't kind of, you know, they didn't line up exactly to what the comics were. this is the opportunity to make a good Batman film with a sense of the realism out of
yeah.
it, and a sense of the, you know, the fiction, the comic book atmosphere in those movies. That's, you know, the opportunity is there. And bringing all of those villains in, you know, you could be in for a very promising, I think it potentially it's going to be a trilogy.
Yeah, and I completely agree with your point. Dark Knight's my favorite movie of all time, and I think the seriousness of it helps The Dark Knight, right? That's what makes it the movie yeah. it is. But it almost ruined a lot of comic book movies in the future because they all tried to emulate that, and it just doesn't work. Yeah. Like, I don't want to see a Superman movie with the realisticness of The Dark Knight. I liked Man of Steel, but, like, that's a story for a different day. I want to see yeah. Superman lift a plane, you know, land it on a ballpark and, you know, smile and say, thanks, everyone. Like, give us a little bit of campiness. Have him yeah. wear the red underwear. Like, I want to see in the new Batman movie when Paul Dano comes out as the Riddler, he better be wearing a ridiculous green suit with a crazy green hat with a question mark on it. You
Absolutely.
Know, whereas if you make that in the DCEU, he's wearing a dark olive, you know, suit with no question marks. And it's just sort of implied that he's the Riddler. Like, no, remove yeah. that. I grew up with the 1966 Adam West Batman. Like, show me Clayface. Show me a crazy CGI Batman fight. Like, you can go out there at this point. Yeah. There's parts of Batman Forever that I think work really well in their campiness.
Oh, they did. Well, I mean, Jim Carrey as the Riddler, I mean, it was a perfect cast. And just, you know, there were parts of that movie that were...
Do you know what I just read about that, by the way? That the original idea for Tim Burton's third Batman... He wanted to cast Robin Williams as
I
the
heard. Yes.
And I had never heard that, but man, that, like, when I read that, it fascinated me, captured my imagination.
He also, here's a fact for you, he also wanted to cast Robin Williams as the Joker in the 1989 movie. So
I didn't know that either.
It was his intention to, he really wanted Robin Williams to be a part of his, either his Batman trilogy or...
Yeah.
I'd heard
and you know what else I read? The third movie in his Batman trilogy, the name of it stunk. It was Batman Continues. Yeah.
Batman Continues.
I know, like, Returns is strong. That's like, yeah. Batman's back, right? And then, like, to go from Returns to, like, Continues.
No.
Kind of weird. Batman Forever, I like. Batman Forever is like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's good. I mean, yeah. Great. The soundtrack's fantastic.
Really good. God. Smashing Pumpkins on that. Seal, yeah.
Seal, U2. You know,
yeah.
It was, I remember that soundtrack. And that's the beauty of the Batman next year. It's set in the 90s. The most, in terms of pop culture, it was, you know, Batman was the biggest thing in the 90s. It was huge everywhere. The animated series, the toys. I mean, I had Batman everything in the 90s.
Yeah.
It was... You know, my
did you have the Batman cereal?
No, we didn't have that.
That was a little before your time, I think.
But my brother was the 80s, and he had Superman. So everything, you know, it's by decades you have certain superheroes and you have certain wrestling, like the 80s.
Of course, the kids that grew up now are going to have the Avengers. That's going to be what they're talking about like this on their podcast in 20 years.
Little shits, I say.
I know, right? Holy shit. We're like, we were looking at the, I guess not we, for me it was Dark Knight, but you were looking at the Michael Keaton Batman. You were like, comic books have never come to the screen in life like this before.
Yeah.
And then you get the Avengers Assemble scene where it's like, it literally looks like a poster I would have on my wall as a kid.
Yeah, I think.
Insane.
I think my first vivid memory of kind of seeing a comic book movie really come to life was Spider-Man in 2002. That was, I think that was the start though of everything. It was the kickstart. Like,
it was. For the new era, it had to be.
It just didn't stop from there. Like, you had.
And Spider-Man 2 was even better, I think. Like, that movie is still one of my favorite superhero movies ever.
Yeah.
With the Doc Ock, with the train rescue scene. Like, there's so much awesome stuff in Spider-Man 2.
Yeah.
I definitely, and then Batman Begins doesn't come too far after that.
Oh, incredible. That's actually my dad's favorite. My dad's a huge comic book fan. a massive Star Wars fan and everything. Like, and he
we've talked about him. I think we've DM'd like comic book theories before that like you and your dad have come up with. I think we were DMing about
and my little brother. My little
was it brother Professor Hulk or something going into Endgame? I think we were like sharing theories, right? Yeah,
we were. Yes, yeah. Professor,
we're really showing the people how big a nerds we are on this one.
It is, man. I mean, with back to Star Wars, my dad. That was released in the cinemas for like a year. My dad's seen it like 20 times when it came out.
And if we were around back then, I'm sure we would be the same way. You know, the phenomenon of that, I can't even imagine. When you watch the documentary showing Star Wars mania, it looks like Beatles mania. Mm-hmm. Like if Endgame felt like what it did for us, Star Wars in 1977 must have just been 10 times that.
Absolutely. I mean, I always ask him, I said, what was it like? What was the reaction like, you know, in the famous I Am Your Father line? And he said, well, it was a typical kind of Irish thing. Like, there was a lot of people going, oh, Jesus Christ. I don't believe it. People saying, I don't believe it.
Yeah. Everyone says that was like in the time between Empire and Jedi, that was like a big point of speculation. Like, is it going to be true? Is it going to be confirmed? And they had Yoda confirm it because he was like the person that people would believe. He's the elder voice of reason.
Yeah.
Crazy. Crazy looking back, right? And like just our whole lives growing up with the fact that like, obviously, yeah, Darth Vader's Luke's father. Mm-hmm. People were living in a time where they were like, no.
Oh, man. But look, Robbie, I can't thank you enough for coming on. Apologies, I should have turned on my light here, but listen, this is mainly for audio, not video. It was a pleasure meeting you 2 years ago with Pat. We had great fun. Hopefully we can meet again. All this madness is over. Hopefully us maybe a Conor fight or a WrestleMania.
That would be amazing. Yeah, both of those things. I'll tell you what, I'm likely to be there. So if you're there, shoot me a Twitter DM, shoot me a text, whatever you got.
Absolutely. And I'm so happy for you. You've achieved so much at such a young age, man. You have such a bright future. And I couldn't be more happier for you. You're a nice guy as well. You know what I mean? And always stay true to being that. You're a really good guy, you know. So fair play to you, man. Really.
Thank you, Al. That means a lot. And this was so much fun. Like I said, like you're one of my favorite people on Twitter. Every video I see where I scroll past, I'm always dying. So this was a blast. I got nothing better to do in quarantine regardless. So trust me, this was my honor. You made my day, Al.
Legend. Thanks so much, Robbie.
Thank you.